Numbers chapter 10 record the use of the two silver trumpets in the life of Israel. And we ought not to miss the evangelical significance of these trumpets, because in fact they have a parallel meaning in gospel terms. You may recall that as we read through, I pointed out the five purposes for which the trumpets were used. In verse 3, first of all, for summoning the whole congregation of Israel, in which case two of the trumpets were blown. And then in verse 4, for summoning the princes, or the leaders only, of the tribes, in which case only one trumpet was blown. And then in verses 5 to 8, as a signal to the people to get themselves ready for marching forwards to the promised land. In verse 9, the trumpets, once the nation was in the promised land, the trumpets were to be blown in a time of war to remind God of the necessities of his people and to appeal to God for help in the conflict. And lastly, the fifth use of the trumpets is found in verse 10 at festivals and sacrifices. And there again, the trumpets were blown to secure the attention of God. Now, my point is this, that if you look at these five uses of the silver trumpets, what you find is this. On the first three occasions, the message of the trumpets is addressed to the people. They were to assemble, or the leaders of the tribes were to assemble, or the nation was to march forwards. The message of the trumpets was a message that was addressed to the people of God. On the last two occasions of the blowing of the trumpets, the message is addressed not to the nation, but to God. And a signal is sent to God from the trumpets to remember God's people in their time of need, perhaps in a time of war, or perhaps at a time of a great festival. And the point is this, that in the first three trumpets, the three soundings of the trumpets, there is a preaching function. The trumpets are blown, and they sound out the declaration of God's will for his people. They are to gather together, the leaders are to assemble, or else they are to march forwards. There is a preaching function in the first blowing of these three trumpets. And in the last two soundings of the trumpets, there is a praying function, because the trumpets are blown the fourth and fifth times to assail the ears of God for help in time of war and of danger. And the message of the five soundings of the trumpets is therefore a twofold message. And it is a message which encapsulates the entire message and function of the life of the Christian church. Preaching is the message of the first three soundings, and prayer is the message of the last two. And these are the two coordinates of the Christian church's life. First of all, words from God for the people. And that's preaching. And then secondly, words for God on behalf of the people. And that is prayer. And these two realities, the preaching of the word and prayer to God, are the sine qua nons of the church's life. And without preaching and prayer, there cannot be a church at all. My feeling today is that on the Christian scene, people will listen to the message of the first three trumpets. They will listen to preaching. And in fact, there still is a tradition of long standing in Scotland of listening to preaching. Some Christians like short doses of the word, what one preacher once called condensed milk. And you can very often tell by people's faces whether they like condensed milk or not. And other Christians like more substantial fare. Some Christians like their preaching to be superficial and shallow, something that doesn't make them think too much. And there are other Christians who like their preaching to have a fair amount of content and of depth. And in general, heed is paid in the churches to the first three trumpets, the sounding out of the word of God, the voice of God to the people, summoning men to hear and to believe and to be saved. But the message of the last two trumpets is largely ignored today, and that is the message of prayer, which assails the ears of God and summons and evokes an answer. Prayer is the sounding of a trumpet in the ears of God. Prayer is a silver blast that moves the hand of God. But it is easier to get people to listen to preaching than it is to get them to pray. They'll listen to the first three trumpets, but they don't want to blow the last two. I was rummaging through some books the other day and came across this book. It's fallen to pieces, actually. It's John Knox's Liturgy from the Scottish Reformation in the 16th century. And looking through all these interminable prayers and services, and they were very long, don't complain. You know that in Germany at the time of the Reformation, morning service started at 7 in the morning and it finished at 12. 5 hours. Excuse me, imagine the state of your roast. What impresses me about John Knox's liturgy is this, that John Knox said that every Reformed church should set aside special days exclusively devoted to prayer. And particularly when some calamity had fallen on men. I was reading the history of Inverness recently and was intrigued at how the Black Death came to Inverness. It came, of course, from the harbour. The harbour was a busier place then than it is now. And ships coming from the east brought the rats with them. And, of course, the rats came ashore down at the harbour and the plague broke out. And the churches in the town were commanded to set aside days of fasting and prayer and penitence for the restraining of God's hand against the plague in the town. And the history also records the great cholera epidemics that used to break out right up to last century. And I'm bound to say that some of my forerunners here in the West Church have a very honourable tradition. During the last great cholera epidemic in the 1800s, Alexander MacGregor, who was the preacher here, used to go around the houses of the poor people who had been stricken with cholera, and he carried with him little enamel cans of soup, and he used to feed the sick people dying of cholera with soup. And in time of war, John Knox's liturgy specified that prayer and fasting and self-examination were commanded by the churches, commanded by God for the churches, so that God might be prevailed upon by the sounding of the trumpet in his ears to restrain his hand and turn the fortunes of men. Now, what Knox was calling for was the sounding of the last two trumpets. Call upon me in the day of trouble, says God, and I will answer you. Seek my face, says God. Knock, and it shall be opened to you. Ask, and you shall receive. And that is the message of the fourth and the fifth trumpets. And yet, in spite of all that, people will not pray. In a recent survey, it was revealed that over 60% of the members in the Church of Scotland never prayed. I could name at least six moderators of the General Assembly who in recent years have urged Christians to come together to intercede to God for the good of the gospel in Scotland and the preservation of Christ's work in our generation. Tom Torrance did it. James Matheson did it. Professor J.S. Stewart did it, to name but a few. And yet people will do anything, absolutely anything in the world, except avail themselves of the fourth and the fifth trumpets. And this is, I may say, one of the major lessons that all the churches in Scotland need to learn in our time. And until that lesson is learned by the churches, the problems of the churches will go on, and they'll not only go on, they will increase and they will multiply. The falling communion rolls and the falling attendances and the falling numbers of parents bringing children for baptism, and the number of churches closing their doors, and shortages of money, and shortages of manpower, all of that will go on and increase until men and women who name the name of Christ learn to come together to pray. Preaching is the message of the first three trumpets. Prayer is the message of trumpets 4 and 5. And it's a message that all the churches need to learn in Scotland. And if preaching and prayer are the message of the trumpets, then the message of verses 11 to 28 is the progress of a church militant. Because in these verses 11 onwards, you get the picture of Israel marching through the wilderness. I always used to imagine in my boyhood a kind of rabble going through the wilderness. But Numbers makes it plain that this is anything but a rabble. The Church of God is an army on the move, and everything has its place, and everyone as his place. Did you notice how the church moved? First of all came the Ark of God, which was the symbol of God's presence with his people. And that was the spearhead of the column. And the message of the Ark is, the Lord of hosts is with us. When the cloud came down on the Ark, God was with his people. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. And then behind the ark, there came the first three tribes. Judah, the leading tribe, the forerunner of Christ the Messiah, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, marching on. And then the Levites, the Merarites, and the Gershonites, carrying the materials for the tabernacle. And then another three tribes, and again the Kohathites, carrying the holy things, the golden lampstand, the table of incense, the table of showbread, all the precious things for the worship of God. And behind them, another three tribes. And behind them, another three tribes. And you know, my friend, to see all of that marching through a desert must have been a truly terrifying spectacle. It must have been an awe-inspiring sight to see an army like that on the move. In fact, it was the promise of God, and you find this throughout the book of Deuteronomy. It was the promise of God that when the nations round about saw the church of God on the move, they would be terrified. They would be paralyzed with fear to see the people of God marching on. And it's interesting that one of the persons to discover this was none other than Rahab the harlot. She isn't called a woman of faith for nothing. If you turn to the book of Joshua, the second chapter, this great lady with a sordid past who trusted God, and she trusted God because she had heard the stories about this church marching through the wilderness. Joshua chapter 2 and verse 8, and she's speaking to the spies whom she's about to release. Chapter 2 and verse 8. Before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, the Israelite spies, "I know that the Lord has given you the land." Isn't that extraordinary? A prostitute. She trusted God. And she knew that the land belonged to this nation. "I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us." That's what God promised. People would look at the church and be afraid, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. "For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no courage left in any of us because of you." It would be wonderful if the Church of Christ could have that kind of impact in the world today. Our hearts melted, and there was no courage left in any man because of you. And if you turn to Numbers chapter 22, it's the beginning of the story of Balaam, the false prophet who was employed to curse Israel and who failed so disastrously to curse the work of God, because of course you cannot curse what God has blessed. Numbers 22. And Balak is watching the church coming through the sand. Numbers 22. "Then the people of Israel set out and encamped in the plains of Moab, on the other side of the Jordan, at Jericho. And Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And Moab, his people, was in great dread of the people, because they were many, many. They were afraid of the church of God. Moab was overcome with fear of the people of Israel. Moab said to the elders of Midian, 'This horde,'" That was his name for the church of God. This horde. Wonder what they call us. This horde will now lick up all that is round about us, as the ox licks up the grass of the field. And so Balak, the son of Zippor, who was king of Moab at that time, sent messengers to Balaam, the professional preacher, the son of Beor at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of Amau, to call him, saying, "Behold, the people has come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth, and they are dwelling opposite me. Come now. Curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them from the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." In Balaam's prophecy in chapter 24, this is one of the things he said when he opened his mouth to curse the work of God. Numbers 24, verse 5. "How fair are your tents, O Jacob?" This is him watching his army on the march. "How fair are your tents, O Jacob, your encampments, O Israel? Like valleys that stretch afar, like gardens beside a river, like aloes that the Lord has planted, like cedar trees beside the waters. Water shall flow from his buckets, and Israel's seed shall be in many waters. His king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. God brings him out of Egypt. He has, as it were, the horns of the wild ox. He shall eat up the nations, his adversaries, and break their bones in pieces." Verse 9, right at the end. "Blessed be everyone who blesses you, Israel, and cursed be everyone who curses you." And you know, that's what a living church should be like. A living church of Christ should be a force to be reckoned with and taken note of, and a voice to be heard. The church of God marched through the desert, and the one thing you couldn't do was ignore it. If you know the story, you'll know the tragedy. They forgot their destiny, this army. Do you know that that army was only 11 days away from Kadesh Barnea, which was on the borders of the land? They were on the threshold of their destiny. 11 days, and that army could have reached the land. But she wandered for 38 years in the sands, until all the men who came out of Egypt, with the exception of Caleb and Joshua, had died. A church that lost its destiny. But Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world." And a living church ought to be a church to be reckoned with, like this magnificent procession marching through the wilderness. And you know, my friend, there was a day when this was so, until quite recently in Scotland. Did you know that 30 years ago, the General Assembly in Edinburgh was a major national event? I can still recall overseas night. In the assembly hall, it was a crowded affair. You needed tickets to get in. And the galleries were thronged by people who had queued for hours just to get into the assembly hall to hear about the onward march of the gospel overseas and watch the consecration of the new missionaries. That was the old overseas night. It's not like that anymore. Of course, the Overseas Council has changed its name. World Mission and Unity. And the evening is one of the dullest in the General Assembly's calendar. Church is ignored. And even the General Assembly is of little public interest. I can still recall when on the opening day of the General Assembly, the streets of Edinburgh were thronged with crowds. 4 years ago, a lady turned to her friend on the high street and she said, "I think there must be something on. There's a car with men in it wearing funny clothes." It was the Lord High Commissioner's procession. It was the stewards and the heralds of Scotland driving up the high street from Holyrood Palace to go to the General Assembly, and no one was taking the slightest interest. I think there must be something on. There's a car in it with people wearing funny clothes. And that's a far cry from the day in 1843 when over one third of the ministers of the Church of Scotland marched through the streets of Edinburgh from St. Andrew's Church in George Street, where the assembly was then held, down George Street to Tanfield Hall at the end of the Canongate to form the Disruption Church. And you know, the streets were packed. They had to call out the police to control the traffic. The traffic was stopped, and the crowds gathered to cheer these men of courage and conviction. Men who'd given up their salaries and their manses and their livings for conscience' sake. Thomas Chalmers preached a great sermon on the text, "Unto the righteous there ariseth a light in the darkness." And you know, it sets Scotland on fire. And it's recorded that when the ministers started coming out of St. Andrew's to form the Free Church, marching down to Tanfield Hall, the first to come was Welsh. He was the moderator. He walked out to the consternation of the ministers who remained, I may say. And when the ministers started pouring through the doors and down George Street, it's recorded that the crowds shouted, "Thank God! They come! They come! Thank God! They come!" You see, we are called on to be a church militant. The ark, the tribes, the tent bearers, the tribes, the holy things, the tribes. We're called on to be an army on the move. And it is to this that Christ calls us today. We ought to be an army for Jesus, summoning the world to sit up and take notice. And lastly, the chapter finishes with the touching and the moving story of Hobab. He was the son of Jethro, whose other name was Reuel, verse 29. Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite. Well, you may know that Moses was married to Hobab's sister, Zipporah. And so here he is evangelizing his brother-in-law. And that's quite a hard thing to do. And what made it hard was this. Moses spent the first 40 years of his life in Egypt, learning the wisdom of the Pharaohs. He spent the second 40 years of his life in Midian. He had to run there after he murdered the Egyptian. And in Midian, God trained him to be a shepherd leader. God likes shepherds to lead his people. He isn't like bully boys or tyrants. David was a shepherd. Moses was a shepherd. Jesus is a shepherd. God likes shepherds to be in charge. Moses lived in Midian for 40 years. And so you see, Hobab, his brother-in-law, knew all about God. After all, it was in Midian that Moses met Jehovah at the burning bush. And so Hobab would have known about Israel and about the escape from Egypt. And yet he had never surrendered personally to God. He knew it all, and he heard it all. And he had lived with his father Jethro, who was a man of God, and with his brother-in-law Moses, who was a man of God. But he never committed himself personally to the living God, the God of wonders. And the call of God came to Hobab there. And Moses challenged this man, who knew it all with his head, to throw in his lot with the children of God. Now I know that some of you here tonight are in that position. You have known about Christ all your life. You have lived it all your life. And I'm asking you tonight to commit your life to Christ. Moses said to Hobab, come with us and we will do you good. For the Lord has promised good to Israel. And that is the invitation of Christ in the gospel. Come with us, and we will do you good, for the Lord has promised good to Israel. And it's interesting that Hobab said no at first. He wasn't inclined to commit himself personally to this God. But Moses persisted in his soul winning. And it seems that Moses succeeded, and Hobab did in fact commit his life personally to the living God. And that is the call of Christ. You see, he was an informed man. He knew the facts. Moses knew that he knew the facts. And on the basis of these facts, Moses invited him to come to God. And on the basis of the facts of the gospel, I invite you to come to Christ tonight. See, it's not enough to know it with your head. You've got to know it with your heart. You've got to know him with your heart. And it is to that that God invites you. Amen. May God add a blessing to the preaching of his word.